This is kind of a funny place to start this message in mid-June, but one of my all-time favorite Christmas movies is It's a Wonderful Life. And if you've seen that movie, you know that it's kind of like this movie about a guy who's sort of having like a midlife crisis, who's starting to look at his life and say, there were a lot of things I wish I would have done differently. There are a lot of, I haven't kind of been able to travel the world like I wanted to. My vocation hasn't worked out like I wanted it to. And so he goes through this moment where he wishes that he wasn't alive, and then he's able to experience the world and his town and the people that he knew as if he hadn't existed. And through that, there's this kind of a goofy angel figure named Clarence. And at one point near the end of the movie, Clarence says, "No man is a failure who has friends." And it's such a nice reminder that even if vocationally George Bailey hadn't accomplished the things he wanted to do, that even if he hadn't fulfilled, he had all of these aspirations to travel the world and to see things, and even if he hadn't done that, even if he hadn't accumulated the wealth and the experiences that he thought he was going to, that he wasn't a failure because of the relationships that he had in his life. There's a similar notion expressed in kind of a negative tense in one of my favorite novels of all time. So this is a little bit of my favorites this morning. In kind of the American epic, East of Eden by John Steinbeck, there's this line that comes in where it says, "When a man comes to die, no matter what his talents and influence and genius, if he dies unloved, his life must be a failure to him, and his dying a cold horror." And in both of those statements, and in both of those stories, really, the movie and the book, our relationships are expressed as one of the most central areas of importance in our lives. The people that we're able to impact around us, the people that are in our families, the people that we interact with every day. The idea is that these people are really what add such a level of richness and meaning to our lives and an experience of joy in our lives. We can quickly affirm the line from Clarence the Angel. You know, we do that all the time. When we come home from work, and we've had a tough time, a tough season, or just a bad day at work, it's a comfort when we experience friends and family and neighbors that we're able to love, that support us, that we're able to enjoy the company of, that we're able to be, you know, encouraged by in moments where we're discouraged, that we're able to celebrate with in moments of happiness. It's easy for us to look and to say, even when things are going poorly in life, if there are people that I care about and people that I'm surrounded by that care about me, then life isn't really so bad. And while we don't like to think of it, the picture in this quote from John Steinbeck is also pretty true. That a lot of things in life can be going very well for us. When he says that line, no matter what his talents and influence and genius, no matter what we're able to do, no matter the power or the influence or the authority that we have, no matter how smart we are, no matter how much we've accomplished, at the end of the day, when we're lonely, the accomplishments that we have don't really feel like accomplishments. The good things going on in our lives don't really feel as good. It makes the moments that are good less good when we lack relationships. And even in kind of this dark language used, if we come to the end of our lives alone, it makes our death like a cold horror. And that's dark, but we've probably seen people in that kind of an experience. For myself, when I was growing up, we lived down the road from a nursing home facility, and it was a facility that specialized in care for folks who had Alzheimer's. And so I worked there that was kind of my first real job when I turned 16 until I graduated college. So I worked in a kitchen in this nursing home that specialized with Alzheimer's care. And if you've had people that you know that have experienced Alzheimer's, you know that it's this awful disease that begins by affecting the mind of people who are otherwise oftentimes very physically healthy. But as the disease progresses, people begin to lose First, it's kind of the memory, it's short-term memory, and they kind of begin to have lapses. And then as it advances, they begin to lose memory of these important moments that they had in life. And then many of us have experienced that kind of moment where you go in to see a family member and they don't remember who you are. And when you see that kind of an isolation, you see people who oftentimes, and I'd see this over and over again, even though they look healthy, they kind of begin to wilt. And when he says cold horror, that's accurate. You see people who are afraid a lot of the time because they don't really know what's going on around them, and they have a difficult time being able to process what's going on in their lives and what's happening around them. And in that kind of disease, that horrible disease, we see this truth playing out that relationships are this key area of importance in our lives. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, Solomon begins to address that, and he begins to describe how relationships are things that bring happiness and joy into the lives that we lead. And so we're going to start reading in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 1. And before we get into that, I know this is a little bit early to do any kind of like a rabbit trail in a message, so this is going to be brief. But when we left off last week, we didn't quite finish Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And you might notice we didn't read a section of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. So we're working the whole way through this book. We're not quite working through the book verse for verse. And so before we get into chapter 4, verse 1, I just want to say, you should finish reading chapter 3. You should check it out. And in that, there's a piece in there that a lot of people who are critical of Scripture, where they say Solomon contradicts himself, and where they say he even really brings into question the whole idea of an afterlife. Because in that later part of chapter 3, Solomon says, just in the same way that he's compared us to all other people and said death is this great equalizer for all people, he says, hey, death equalizes us with animals as well. He says, he kind of gives this notion that sometimes we think we're so much better and smarter and more intelligent and more accomplished than the animals that we live. But at the end of the day, a great king like Solomon and a pig who hangs out in the mud all day, they're both going to be equal in the fact that they both are going to pass from this life. And so he kind of raises the question, what happens after that point? And so lots of people will say, Solomon's kind of saying an afterlife doesn't even exist. But there are lots of places where he does say that. He said that in the passage we read in chapter 3. He says that at the end. He talks about this idea that God judges and takes into account the actions of our life. So he doesn't say an afterlife doesn't exist. But he talks about this great equalizer. So with that in mind, let's begin reading in chapter 4, verse 1. And as we do that, what we see in this is kind of the trend we've seen a couple times throughout Ecclesiastes, where he starts describing something that is bad, and then he shifts into describing something that's good. In Pastor David Gibson, who wrote about Ecclesiastes, he says, basically, in this section, what we see is that Solomon lays out that there are two ways for us to live. We can live for ourselves, and we can see other people as a means to accomplish what we want in life, or we can love our neighbors as ourselves. So beginning in verse 1, it says, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed. And they had no comfort, they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. So interestingly, this discussion on the meaning of life and the way we relate to each other begins by describing these relationships that take place between people, where some people are being oppressed and some people are living and acting as the oppressors of other people. And this is something that Solomon sort of describes as the human existence, and that we have seen take place over and over and over throughout ages of humanity and in cultures and civilizations, even around the world to this day, that if there are two groups of people occupying a place, if there are multiple people occupying a place, and someone is in power, oftentimes that relationship of power transforms into a relationship where certain people are acting as the oppressors and are using other people, are oppressing other people to fulfill their own desires and to meet their own ends. So Solomon kind of steps back and he says, this is part of kind of the human condition that we experience. And certainly we see this in our culture. With dynamics of power and oppression and fear of people who grasp because they're afraid to lose power and authority and control that they have. We see this kind of thing happen in culture all the time. And it's interesting that Solomon begins by talking about people that are oppressed. And he says kind of, it's not surprising that a civilized person would say, think of these people that are oppressed and lament the situation that they're in life. Think of these people that are being used. And kind of pity them. Think of these people that are in this place of struggling, that don't have the power and the authority, so someone else is manipulating them to fulfill their own selfish kinds of desires. And he says to kind of think about their existence in this life. And he says, not only is that a poor way to live, but it would be better to be dead than to live under oppression. And even better to be dead, he says, it would be better to have never been born than to be someone who lives in a way that is oppressed. And it's interesting that Solomon starts here because he's an oppressor in his role as king. If we read 2 Chronicles in chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, it says this, Solomon took a census of all the foreigners residing in Israel. After the census his father David had taken, and they were found to be 153,600. He assigned 70,000 of them to be carriers, and 80,000 of them to 80,000 to be stone cutters in the hills, with 3,600 foremen over them to keep the people working. And assigned is a nice word used to describe what he did. He forced the foreigners in his land into completing his great building projects, into fulfilling the great aspirations that he had to be a great king. He enslaved them. Solomon took a census to determine all the foreigners that were there, and then he assigned them, he conscripted their labor to fulfill the desires that he had to develop his kingdom. He witnessed the pitiful state of the oppressed because he oppressed over 150,000 people. And then he goes on to say this, to get back into Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. Solomon, while he never comes out in this story and admits that he, has fulfilled this role as oppressor, he states that he recognizes that oppression has this foundation of being envious of our neighbors. And while he lived this out on a grand scale, Solomon was able to look at kings that had gone before them and compare himself to the great King David, to his father. Solomon was able to look at kings in neighboring kingdoms and be able to compare them to the things he had accomplished. And he says in this state of envy, that we're able to look and see what our neighbors have accomplished and we desire what they have. And so we do whatever it takes for us to be able to accomplish that. And that envy leads us to desiring more, and that desire for more leads us to see other people as a stepping stone to be able to get what we want in life. In saying all of that, what Solomon really says, and what we don't think about a lot, is that on one hand, we should pity people who are being oppressed, and on the other hand, we shouldn't look at it as kind of people who are being oppressed and people who are oppressing. We should pity the oppressors as well. The people in power and the people who do not have power are both people to be pitied, because even the people who are in power, who are enacting these cycles, they're people who are chasing after the wind. They're people who are living a meaningless life. They're people who don't understand what life is all about, and so they're living in this way that will never satisfy them. And then he goes on in kind of a verse that seems funny but makes sense. Whenever he says the fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh, he's also quick to say this. Hey, if you're someone who's fully ambitious and you're always working and you're always grasping and you're always looking for meaning, then you're living the wrong way. But he's also, when he says the fool kind of sits back with his hands folded and eats his own flesh, he's saying, if you're lazy, if you don't have any ambition, if you're just kind of sitting back, letting life come to you, then that's wrong as well. And he goes on to say, better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. So there's this idea that both oppressors and the oppressed are to be pitied that we see in this verse. And this is an idea that even though Solomon was king, even though he wrote multiple books of the Bible, this is not the idea that he was able to enslave foreigners and do whatever he wanted with them. It is not something that the Old Testament really testifies to us. We see repeatedly in the Old Testament the way that people are supposed to treat others. You see it mostly come out in the work of the prophets, where the prophets had this role, and lots of times when we think of prophet, we think of the role of being able to foresee a circumstance with God, and that's part of it, that God lets them know, hey, if this needs to happen or else this is going to happen, or just this is going to happen. Sometimes that role of prophet is in foreseeing the future. Oftentimes that role of prophet was saying to people, hey, you've gone wrong in these areas, and God is calling you to come back and be faithful to him in this area. And this happened many times over and over when it came to the way that God's people treated others. In the ministry of Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, in Zechariah, in Amos, and in Micah, the people were cautioned and told that they needed to be treating people well, that they needed to be taking care of each other and not oppressing each other, that they needed to be taking care of people who were defenseless, that they needed to be taking care of the foreigners who were among them. We see this in Zechariah chapter 7, verses 9 and 10, when it says, this is what the Lord Almighty said, administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the foreigner or the poor. Do not plot evil against each other. And Solomon doesn't let the oppressors off the hook, but he does say, it isn't like one person is living in glory and the other person is living miserably. When it's an oppressor and an oppressed relationship, both people are living pitiful lives. And he goes on to say we need to have balance in our aspirations and the desires we have in life. This is that idea of saying the person who's overly ambitious or the person who's kind of sitting back with both hands folded and kind of lazily enjoying life and whatever comes to them. When we think about this, to contextualize it for us today, we often hear this story, you know, this kind of, it's like an encouragement sometimes for people who are really busy or who have demanding jobs, where someone will say, hey, you know, at the end of your life, whenever you look back on it, you're never going to say, I wish that I missed one more, kind of fill in the blank, dinner with family, a baseball game with my son, an opportunity to watch my daughter play soccer, any of those, you know, we'll never sit back at the end of a busy life and say, I really wish that I missed one more family thing so that I could get a project done and meet a deadline or get something done early. And so we hear that a lot. Solomon would kind of say, that's right. If we live with all ambition and envy of our neighbors and trying to get more and more, we're never satisfied. He also says this, that if we're people who are content to sit on the couch and binge watch Netflix all day long, we're never at the end of our life going to say, I wish I got in one more season or one more show on Netflix. We're never going to sit back and say, that was the way that I lived and that was a good way to live. So he gives this picture in the text of someone who has one hand in quietness, is how he describes it. It's almost like saying someone who has one hand at peace and the other hand that is still ambitious and striving for things. But he says that we need to be people who have balance. That we need to be people who live with the understanding that having too much and pursuing too much and being too envious is never good enough for us. And it leads us to this place of oppression. And then, in verse 7, he begins to talk about the life-giving nature of relationships. It won't sound like that at first, but that's what he's saying. He says, again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother. Yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Verses 7 and 8, you know, on one hand, it sounds like you could read this negatively, and once again, he's talking about life being vanity and meaningless and things like that. But if we think about this and look at it in the opposite context, what Solomon is saying in this passage is that he's expressing how life lived with other people, and really even for other people, is something that brings us happiness. That when we're caring and striving on behalf of others, that's something that brings us joy. That when we're doing all of that for ourselves, we're never satisfied. We can never kind of be full enough. But whenever we're someone who is working for others, on behalf of others, that there's a happiness that comes with being able to do that for other people. And then he goes on in one of the most popular passages of this book to say, beginning in verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. And in this kind of classic wedding reading verse, there is so much that is written about the value of the relationships that we have. Solomon explains that life is better when we live it alongside of others. He says that instead of exploiting people in order to get what we want, in order to try to get what we want, we should be people that live in relationship and partner with others. The first thing he says in verses 9 and 10 are that instead of toiling on our own and by ourselves, that we should partner up. And he doesn't mention the value of relationships in any kind of like a mushy or emotional or kind of like Father's Day card kind of way. He talks strictly about the kind of strategic importance and value of relationships in these passages. He says, look, if two people are working together, they can get more done. If two people are working together and one person's failing, the other person can help them out. If two people are working together on the same project, they'll be compensated more. They'll be able to reap a greater reward than either of them could get working on their own. He just espouses kind of a general wisdom to working together. And in verse 11, he moves into this analogy that has oftentimes been understood as a reference to the marriage relationship between husband and wife. And some people say that's what he's referring to when he talks about two people lying down together, and that makes sense. Other people say all three of these things, working together, lying down together, and kind of defending yourself, that this is kind of the image of a traveler on the road, and that he's really kind of talking about practical wisdom of being together in life. And so it would be a very different kind of lying down together that he's talking about. But either way, in either context, what he's saying in the passage is this very tangible benefit of being in relationships with other people. And he wraps it up with this idea of finding strength in numbers. It's safer to go through life with one other person than it is to go through life alone. It's better to go through life with a whole group of people than it is to go through life alone. To have multiple people to help you, to defend you, to protect you, and to be able to do that for them as well is important. And so in this chapter, Solomon reveals this kind of profound truth when we think about it. He explains that even though many people, in an attempt to live a good life, we have these greedy desires of our heart that we enact by using other people to get what we want, he said the ironic thing is that never works for us. That we can be powerful, that we can have people who are under our authority, that we can manipulate people and make them do what they want, that we can seek out those kinds of people in order to try to use them to accomplish what we want in life. But he says the ironic thing is that even with all of the people that we could try to control or have power over or manipulate, the reality is that we never experience the satisfaction of having enough, that we never experience the satisfaction of oppressing enough people or manipulating enough people to really get what we want in life. And yet, there's another way to live. And before we say, hey, Solomon, what authority does he have to speak on that? He had 150,000 slaves. He had 700 wives. Many of them were married in an attempt to serve him. He had 300 concubines. There are no doubt more servants that he had. He's a guy who had a lot of people under his authority and had the ability to manipulate them and tell them to do whatever he wanted, and if he desired, to oppress them to get what he wanted in life. But he says that doesn't satisfy. The irony comes in when he says that if we suppress our ambitions that are driven by envy, if we don't live in that kind of a way, and if we look to be in relationship with other people, if we foster and care for other people and the relationships that we have with them, if we spend time investing in other people, that our lives aren't damaged by that investment, they're strengthened. They're made better by that investment. When we think about the failures that we experience in life, like we talked about at the beginning, when we have a bad day at work, when we help a neighbor out with a project, when we stop and we see a total stranger, and lots of us have had that experience, when there's someone that you have never met before in your life, you've never seen before in your life, and you stop to be able to help them, you help someone, but oftentimes you feel better in that process. You experience that sense of internal happiness in that, and by investing and inconveniencing yourself for someone else, and it's not like some magic formula or trick, it just makes your life better. This is the experience that almost every person I've ever talked about going on a mission trip has had, where they thought, oh, I went and my intent was to be able to help people and to do this project, and I sacrificed for it. I gave up vacation time. I gave up weekends doing fundraisers. I wrote letters to family. I did all of those kinds of things to go and to be a part of this trip. And at the end, it enriched my life as well by being able to help other people. We often find this strange dynamic where when we try to get everything, we're never satisfied. And when we try to give ourselves away and help others and invest in others, we live lives that are rich with meaning. And this isn't just something that we find in the words of Solomon as he searches for meaning in life. This is something that Jesus instructs his followers in very clearly. In Mark 12, verses 29 to 31, in the very well-known passage when the authorities are trying to kind of bait Jesus into giving a poor answer to a question about the most important law. He says this in verse 29. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And of course, Jesus didn't just tell other people to do this. He didn't just pay lip service to this. Over and over and over again in the Gospels, we see the way that Jesus instructed us and showed us how it is that we are to be people that love and care for others. We see him do this as he provides for people who have nothing that they can give back to him in return. We see him do this as he miraculously heals people who don't offer him anything in return. It isn't that he's trying to get the, you know, it's not a this for that kind of relationship. We see him do this with his disciples as he encourages them to care for and to provide for other people without looking for something in return. Well, we certainly see this ultimately in the story of Christ, who loves us so much that he gives his own life on our behalf. Solomon explains to us that it is wise to invest in others, that there's good practical reasons why our lives are made better by caring for other people. Jesus tells us that it is important that we love others as people that call ourselves followers of him. The John Steinbeck quote that I began the message with, it's followed by another line that I think is even more powerful than the first, as he says this. It seems to me that if you or I must choose between two courses of thought or action, we should remember our dying and try so to live that our death brings no pleasure to the world. One of the best things we glean from the book of Ecclesiastes, from the writings of Solomon, is the perspective that we need to remember as we live today that one day we will pass from this life. It's written all throughout there that we're the same as everyone else because we all die someday. That we live the same kind of existence as the animals. We try to provide for ourselves. We try to get by in life, and one day we die. One of the most important things we see in Ecclesiastes is that we should live today with the remembrance and the acknowledgement that someday our lives will end. We need to live in the kind of way where we're not chasing everything we have with ambition, and we're not just in thinking that we don't have any time to enjoy life, or we're not sitting back and just doing whatever we want in life without any concept that someday it might end for us. We need to live and to remember that there is an end to our lives. So this morning I would ask you, let's be people that live in a manner that our death would not bring pleasure to the world around us. Let's be people that seek the best lives for the people around us. Let's be a people that live out the love and the way of living that Christ modeled for us and has instructed us to follow. Let's be a people that choose to look for opportunities to invest in others instead of opportunities to manipulate others to accomplish our own ends. And let's be a church that works together to demonstrate this kind of love and care to a world around us that is bitterly divided, is desperately broken, and is wildly in need of Christ. As we experience the love and care of Jesus personally, he enables us to be people that follow his lead in laying down our lives on behalf of others.